Black sand. The crunch of it under a foot not hers. Breath, hers, shallow, carried. A body moving her, easy, the way you move cargo that must not shift. The dawn is gray and warm against her face, and the air smells of steam and salt and rock. Water somewhere, close, breathing against stone. The walls of the sea cave stand black around them, wet, sliced by vents that hiss white into the morning. Under everything, under the hiss and the water and the breathing, a hum. Not loud. Not wind. Not the sea. A pulse in the rock itself, so low it is felt before it is heard, in the arches of the feet, in the chest, in the hollow where Kale's own hum lives, quiet and waiting. The carried woman stirs. The hum in the stone does not. It has been waiting, the hum. Long before the ship. Long before the fog. Longer than the black cliffs standing at the edge of the world, patient as a held note. The footsteps stop. The shore breathes. The stone hums. She came back to herself on a world that hummed. The sound was in her before the light was, a low constant weight in the stone under her back, in the wet air over her face, in the place between her ribs where her own note slept. Kale opened her eyes to black rock curving overhead, to steam drifting white across a gray dawn, and for a long moment she did not know if she was awake or still in the sea's aftermath, held in the shape of the wave she had unsung. Easy. Velani said. The trader's voice, close, dry, cracked down the middle the way it had been on the dead flat water.
You're ashore. We're ashore. Whatever that was, it's behind us.
Behind them. Kale turned her head, the movement cost her, the hollow in her chest widening like a bruise, and saw the tide kind moored in the sea cave behind them, her broken mast and scarred deck black against the wet rock, and beyond the cave mouth a slice of gray water where the fog hung, at the edge of hearing, keeping pace. It had not moved. It had not dispersed. It was waiting, patient as the note in the stone, and Kale understood both readings at once, as she had learned to. The fog was following, and the fog was waiting, and on Vorn the two were the same thing. Velani had carried her ashore. Of course she had. The trader stood with Kale's weight still settling on the black sand between them, her hands on Kale's shoulders, checking, appraising the way she appraised cargo, whole, damaged, what would hold. Her jaw was tight. She said nothing about it. Saravai did not burden each other. Behind them on the sand, Brother Melon was binding his head with a strip torn from his own sleeve, moving slow, his scholar's hands steadier than they had been in the fog. The gash from the strait had opened again in the landing. The cloth came away red and he pressed it back, wincing, and did not complain. The man who had used them for his pilgrimage had stopped apologizing for it, which was its own kind of honesty. And Varin. Varin stood at the waterline where the last of the sea's tongue licked the black sand, his back to them, and he had not spoken since the storm. He looked at the cave walls the way a man looks at a text he cannot read, seeking the shape of a word in the wet black strata, in the steam's slow cursive, finding nothing. He had not prayed. He did not pray now. The silence where his prayer had been was the loudest thing on the shore. Kale opened her mouth to say something, to Melon, to Velani, to no one, and the cave harbor answered her with its resonance, the low stone hum that had been there since before the ship, and the note measured her silence and found it small. Then there were footsteps from the dark. Not on the sand, in the tunnel mouth at the back of the cave, where the rock opened into deeper black. A weight of steps, slow, deliberate, unhurried as the tide. Kale's hand found Velani's arm before she decided it. Melon's breathing stopped. Even the steam held. He came out of the dark into the gray dawn, and the hum came with him, the hum was in him, or he was in the hum. Kale could not separate them. He was old, older than the cliffs, older than the fog. Gray-skinned, taller than any human, broad across the shoulders, with hands that ended not in fingers but in ridges like chitin, worn smooth with use. His eyes held no white, black stone upon black stone, patient as the cave, and he looked at each of them, one by one, at Melon's bandaged head, at Varen's unreadable stillness, at Valani's guarded stance, at the spent girl in the traitor's arms. He stopped on Kale. The eyes without white held hers, and the hum in the stone rose to meet something in her, rising, clarifying, a struck string answering a struck string across a room gone dark. Her own note stirred in her chest, quiet, present, the thread restrung in the night, rising toward the sound without her permission, the way a wire answers rain. She could not have stopped it if she tried. She did not try. The old one hummed. A note so low it vibrated in their chests, in Melon's red fingers, in Varen's still hands, in the hollow where Kale's note rose to meet it and held, trembling, a hairbreadth of a note, an answer she had not chosen. Then he turned and walked into the tunnel and did not look back. He expected them to follow. Valani looked at Kale. Kale looked at the dark mouth of the tunnel, then at the fog beyond the reach of ears, then at the place where the old one had stood with the hum still settling in his wake. She had crossed the worst sea in the known world carrying a word no one could read. She had been carried ashore by a woman who could not protect her from being what she was. And now the only being who had come to meet them had not said a word, and there was nothing to do but follow a stranger into the dark, on a world that hummed, because the fog would not help them and the sea would not answer twice. Kale let go of Valani's arm and put one foot on the black sand and followed. The tunnel opened into sky. Not the gray dawn sky of the shore, a warmer air, a green light, a valley hidden in the mountain's heart. Steam vents breathed white from the black rock, hot springs pooled in terraces of mineral-veined stone, moss glowed phosphorescent on every surface, green gold, soft as breath. And cut into the cliffs on every side, stone structures, doors, windows, shelves of rock that had been lived in for so long the stone had learned their shapes. The settlement was quiet. Not the quiet of abandonment, the quiet of a place that had never needed to shout. Kale heard the moss, if that was possible, the water in its terraces, the low constant hum of the whole valley, the same note as the shore, now everywhere, the world itself breathing in the stone. The old one, the hum carrier, the one who had read her chest like a text, did not slow. He walked through the settlement's heart and did not look back, and the Uargrim who came to their doorways watched them pass, gray figures, tall and still, holding their children's hands. No one spoke. No one called out. They watched the surface dwellers the way you watch weather. Melon's voice found its scholar's rhythm, low and wondering. Forgetting the bandaged head.
Skeltor.
Hollow speech. The shame of it, speaking without humming. They do not speak to each other the way they speak to us. The young ones hum to the old hum back. We are addressed in words, and the words are a condescension. A kindness. He said it to no one, reading the valley the way he read a scriptorium. They are talking over our heads because our heads are all they think we have. Kale understood the words and felt the shape of them. Cast out of the song. Spoken to in the tongue of trade scrolls and strangers because they were not worth humming to. The humility of it settled on her like the valley's warm damp. They brought her to a healing cave. Warm, damp, the walls slick with minerals that caught the glow-moss light and held it. They laid her on a shelf of stone padded with moss, and the one who tended her was an elder, older than the rest, her gray skin folded like old leather, her hands knowing human anatomy the way a cooper knows a barrel. She worked without words, reading Kale's pulse at the wrist, tilting her face to the light, pressing the places where the unseen had hollowed her. Her touch was certain and did not apologize. Then the elder straightened and looked past Kale at Villani and spoke. Her Ethryn was formal, ancient, every word pronounced as if tasting it. You carried her. Why? Kale watched Villani's face. The trader who could talk her way through any port, who appraised strangers by their hands, who had no words for soft things, the question stood in front of her like a toll she had not counted on. Villani could have said what she had said 40 times, cargo, duty, safe passage, the debt of a wreck repaid. Kale knew the shape of those words. They were ready in the trader's mouth. Villani opened her mouth. Closed it. The stone hummed in the silence.
She's mine.
Mine.
We have no word for that, here. A thing is kept for use. Or for return. Mine, we would sing it as a question. She studied the pair of them, the trader standing over the spent girl, the girl's eyes open, watching, too far gone to be part of the argument.
You carried her across the black water, and you will not say for what. She is not cargo.
No.
She's not.
The elder nodded once, and returned to her work, and Kale lay on the moss shelf with the words still in the air, the first time Villani had claimed her aloud, in front of everyone, in a language the whole valley could taste. Kale was conscious enough to hear it. She would not be able to unhear it. Elsewhere in the valley, the settlement's children played among the terraces, and Varen stood apart from them, apart from everything, a strip of figure in a gray robe at the edge of the light, watching. He had followed the party onto this world because the text had failed him twice, and he had no text left, and the not having was all he had. He watched the young of the valley, you are grim children, taller than human children, gray as the stone, humming to each other instead of speaking. The hums crossed the terrace like water, question and answer, answer and question. They said things, those hums, Varen could not read them, but he could hear that they said things, that no one in this valley had ever had to translate a feeling through the machinery of words. One child broke from the others. Approached him, a head taller than he was, grave as a small elder, and hummed, a low rising note, a question. Varen could not answer. He had no song to answer with. His mouth had only shaped prayers and warrants and formal sentences, and none of them were hums, and none of them were true in the way that hum was true. He stood silent, and the child watched him with the whole of its attention, and then it laughed, a bright sound, unashamed, and ran back to the others, humming, leaving Varen at the edge of the light with something raw on his face. These people spoke truth through their bodies. He had never done that in his life. Days passed in Vorn, and time on Vorn was not hours. The Uargrim counted it in thaws, the number of times the black water had been passable since the present peace began, and within a thaw they counted smaller things, the cooking of a pot, the growing of a moss bed, the settling of a roof. Nothing rushed. Kale had been raised in the Dales, where weather decided the business of the day and nothing else did, and even she found the patience of this valley bottomless. It was not laziness. It was not waiting. It was simply that the valley had outlasted everything, and saw no reason to hurry past a single breath. She recovered slowly. The hollow in her chest filled in at its own pace, the note returning to the wire like water returning to a well, a little at a time, measured in what she could do. And what she could do, she did. She helped mend a roof on a storage cave, handed stones up to a gray youth whose hands moved in a rhythm older than the valley, learning the rhythm by handing into it. She learned which mosses made bedding that stayed warm, carried by an elder's silent procession to the gathering pools, matching her stride to theirs. She sat by the fire in the evening and did not try to speak. The Uargrim watched her from their doorways and their terraces with their whole attention, the way the shore had watched, and they measured her as she measured them, by what she did. They communicated through shared action, and Kale, who had never been good at words, who had always said less than she meant and watched people misunderstand the shape of the rest, felt for the first time in her life that the language was not the point. The stone. The fire. The moss. The young one at the other end of the stone. She had been carrying a stone for a threshold, a lintel, too heavy for her, and she had not asked for help because on Vorn you did not ask, you simply carried and the valley decided, and then there was another pair of hands on the other end of it, gray, wordless, lifting with her. No look. No question. The stone moved. They said it, and the young one was gone, and Kale stood with her hands stinging and her heart doing something she did not have a word for. She burned her hand that evening, reaching across a cooking stone the way she had reached across 100 Dales fires, and the heat was not Dales heat, it was the valley's own breath, and it took the skin off her palm before she knew it. An elder appeared at her elbow without sound, took her wrist in gray hands, pressed a poultice of crushed root over the burn, bound it with moss cloth, and was gone. No explanation. No word. The poultice cooled, the pain settled, the valley absorbed the moment as it absorbed everything. Kale sat by the fire with her bound hand and her stinging heart and understood, with a clarity that hurt, what was happening to her. She had been trusted before. Valani trusted her with her life. Melon trusted her with his pilgrimage. But always, always, the trust had needed her words, her explanations, her promises, her bargains, her useful knowledge. The world had taught her that you earn trust by speaking well, and she had learned to speak small and precise and careful. Here, no one wanted her words. They wanted her hands. Her patience. The truth of the stone she carried at the other end of a shared weight. She had been trusted, she was being trusted, hour by hour, day by thaw, by people who did not need her to say a single word, and it undid something in her. His name came to her slowly, as such things did on Vorn, from no one and everyone, a child's humming, an elder's patient voice, and then one evening, plainly. Thrall. His breath name. His song name is not a thing your breath can carry. She said it back until it stopped being strange. Thrall watched from a distance. He was always at the edge of the valley, never in it with her. The hum carrier who had read her on the shore, Kale had not heard his voice since, only his presence, a weight in the air, a stillness at the edge of every scene she was in, a shape at the top of every terrace. He was watching her. She knew it the way she knew rain coming. He was not testing her patience by ignoring her. What he was testing was her patience, by being patient himself. Kale passed the test by not trying to pass it. She mended the roof. She gathered the moss. She sat by the fire and let the valley hum through her, and did not once try to prove she was worth trusting, and the weight of Thrall's watching, when she noticed it, had something almost like warmth in it. And then, on a day no one counted, an elder came to the fire where Kale sat, and stood in front of her, and spoke. Not to her. Past her. But for her. They took her to the meeting cave, not asked, taken, the way the valley took everything, by simply expecting it. Kale followed because on Vorn you followed, and the guests of a valley did not lead. The meeting cave was deeper than the settlement, warmer, older. The glomos here was thin, gold, laid over walls carved with the same worn markings she was beginning to see everywhere, not writing, someone had told her, impressions, the touch of hands over centuries. Four elders sat in a circle of stones, old beyond old, gray as the rock they sat on, and they looked at her as the shore had looked at her, whole attention, no hurry. Then one of them began to speak, and the others answered, and the language was not Ethryn. Hums. Clicks. Harmonies so low they were felt in the stone floor, harmonics that stacked and resolved and argued. Kale sat in the middle of it and understood nothing, no, worse than nothing. She understood that something was being decided, that the weight in the room was shifting around her the way the fog had shifted around the ship, that she was the subject of a conversation she could not hear, being discussed the way the elders discussed weather and thaws and the settling of roofs. She was being discussed, not included. Thrall was not there. The hum carrier who had read her on the shore had not come to the meeting cave, and his absence was a missing weight, a silence where something should have been standing. The elders spoke for a long time. They argued, Kale could hear the argument in the harmonic stacking, the way a chord argues with itself before it resolves. They disagreed about her, about the word she carried, about something older than the word. Twice the youngest of the four elders, the youngest, still old as the cliffs, made a sound that was almost a word, almost Ethryn, and stopped, and the others' harmonics answered in a chorus that felt, even in Kale's ignorance, like refusal. Then they finished. The silence in the meeting cave was complete. The glomos held its light. The valley's hum, far off, was the only sound, holding its breath with Kale. The eldest of the elders turned to her, and spoke in careful Ethryn, tasting each word.
You carry a word. You will show it to us.
It was not a request. Kale's hand went to her pack before her mind decided it. The fragment, the sealed scrap of the first tongue, the single word she had carried across the worst sea in the known world, the other half of a summons she had answered without knowing she was answering. She brought it out, and the four elders leaned in, and the cave's air went still. It was not much to look at. A scrap of cured hide, old enough to be brittle, scored with a single word in a script no living surface dweller could read. Shattered, Kale had opened it on the third night at sea, and it had meant nothing alone, a word with no mouth, a note with no song. She had carried it north because the fog had asked for the shape of it, and the fog had known what it was, and the elders, maybe, knew too. The eldest took it from her, careful, the way you take a bird's egg, and held it to the light, and the other elders passed it between them, holding it to the glomos, pressing it to their chests, feeling its resonance through the gray folds of their skin. The youngest of the elders gasped. One of the four, the one who had argued first, the one who had refused, wept soundlessly, tears tracking through the folded gray of her cheeks, and she did not explain, and no one asked her to. They returned the fragment to Kale. The eldest's hands closed hers around it, warm, certain, and she looked into Kale's face for a long moment, the way Thrall had, reading a shape there. We will decide in 3 days. she was dismissed. The meeting cave let her go the way it had taken her, by simply expecting it, and Kale walked back into the gold-green light of the valley with the fragment warm in her hand and a cold understanding settling in her chest. What they had decided, she did not know. Whether the weeping had been grief or joy, she could not say. She did not know why the youngest had gasped, or what the word shattered meant to a people who had lived inside the world's wound for 800 years. Yet she knew the word meant something, something that had made an ancient elder weep without sound, and that her fate, and the fragment's fate, and maybe the fate of the hum that had carried her here, were now in hands that did not speak her language. Three days. The longest 3 days of Kale's life, and nothing happened in any of them. She worked. The valley accepted her work as it accepted the weather, and she gave it what she had, her hands, her patience, the slow re-knitting of her strength. The moss shelf in the healing cave had learned her shape. She ate what was given her, moss bread and steam-warmed fish and roots that tasted of the stone they grew through. Evenings she sat by the fire, heard the elders' harmonics arguing in her memory, and did not know what to do with the waiting except to go on doing the things she had been doing, which was, she realized, exactly what the valley expected of her. Then she hummed. She caught herself at it on the second day, mending a net by the pool, humming, softly, an old Dale's work tune, the tune her mother had hummed at the loom, the tune that lived in her the way the hum lived in the stone, and she stopped, out of old training, the Dale's hand over her mouth. A child hummed back. Across the pool, one of the grave gray children, the ones who hummed instead of speaking, answered her, the same note, or near it, a question laid over the tune's end. Kale stared. The child watched her, patient as the stone, waiting for the answer hum. Kale hummed the next line of the tune. The child's ears, small ridges of gray cartilage, tilted, and it hummed the line back, and then it was gone, a small gray shape moving off between the terraces, and Kale sat by the pool with her work forgotten and a thing opening in her chest that she did not have a word for. By the third day the children hummed back when she hummed. All of them. A chorus of small gray voices answering her across the terraces, the whole valley's children learning her tune by ear, and Kale, who had spent her life being trained out of humming, hummed more in 3 days than she had in 3 years. The others found their own places in the waiting. Valani had found her footing, of course Valani had found her footing, Valani would find her footing on the moon. She traded dried fish for a repaired sail, the tide kind's torn main mended by a gray craftsman who had never seen a ship's sail and managed it anyway, because a sail was, when you got down to it, a thing made to catch the wind, and the valley understood catching. She had discovered what the valley used for currency. Not gold. Not goods. Time. You owed a person hours of work, and the debt was kept, paid, and remembered. Valani had been seen keeping a mental ledger, delivered with the flat pleasure of a woman who had found the most interesting cargo on a whole new continent.
They bank hours. I've been here a week and I already know what I owe three of them, and they've already forgotten their owed.
It was the most Valani thing Valani had ever done. Melon had found the scriptorium cave on the first morning, a cave off the meeting cave, walls covered in markings older than anything he had ever seen, older than the Black Ledger's oldest scroll, older, he whispered, than the present peace, than the shadow age, than the first cataclysm's memory. He had been in there ever since. Kale brought him food. He took it without looking at her, transcribing by phosphorescent light in the ecstatic concentration of a man who had found the text of his life. The bandage had come off his head. He had not noticed. Varen sat by the hot spring. That was all. He sat. He did nothing. He did not pray, he had not prayed since the storm, and he did not look for work, and the valley, which had absorbed Kale's work and Valani's trading and Melon's ecstasy, absorbed his stillness as it absorbed everything, without comment. On the second day, an elder sat down beside him. Not the healing elder. The other one, the one who had wept at the fragment, the one with the folded gray face and the patient eyes. She sat on the stone beside Varen, looked out at the steam rising from the spring, and did not speak. She did not leave. An hour passed. The steam rose. The valley hummed. Varen broke first.
What do you want from me?
He said it without turning, the formal priest's voice gone to something thinner, the voice of a man who has run out of the forms of speaking. I have nothing. No office. No answers. No. He stopped. The sentence hung, unfinished, conditional, the way his sentences had been hanging since the storm. The elder considered him with the whole of her attention, as the valley attended to everything. Nothing. That is the point. Varen was silent. The steam rose between them. The elder's folded hands rested on her knees, patient as stone, and something in the silence, the absence of demand, the absence of observation, the sheer unbroken presence of someone who wanted nothing from him, undid something in Varen that the storm and the sea and the burning of his certainties had not quite managed. I don't know how to do that. I have never, no one has ever. The conditional clauses were gone. The sentence was bare.
I don't know how to be sat with.
We know. Varen said nothing for a long time. He did not leave. At dusk, the elder rose, touched his shoulder once, a gray hand, warm, brief, and went back into the valley. Varen sat by the hot spring until the stars came out, and Kale, watching from the terrace above, saw him raise one hand to his face and press it there, and she looked away. Thrall still had not spoken to Kale. He was there, the weight in the air, the stillness at the edge of every scene, the shape at the top of the terraces, watching her as he had watched her on the shore, patient as the stone, saying nothing. She did not approach him. She did not know the words to approach him with, and she had learned on Vorn that the words were not the point, and so she let the silence stand, and the silence stood with her. On the third night, as she sat by the fire, she felt him approach. Not a footstep. A shift in the air, a displacement of the valley's warmth, the hum in the rock leaning toward him as if recognizing a voice. Kale looked up, and Thrall was there, across the fire from her, seated on the stone with the ease of a man who had sat by a thousand fires. He did not speak. He hummed. A low note, rising at the end, a question shaped in the blood and the stone, and Kale did not know the word for it, if it was a word at all, but she understood it, the way she understood the shape of rain coming, the way the wire understood storm. The question was, why are you here? Not why have you come to Vorn? Why are you here? In this moment. By this fire. On this world. What is the true shape of the thing that brought you, under all the words you have not said and the bargains you have not made? Kale looked at the fire. The hum in her chest rose, quiet, answering. She hummed back. The same note, a different ending. An answer without a language, she did not know why she was here. She had been carried here, summoned here, the word and the summons and the fog all pulling her north, and every explanation she had ever given had been a smaller thing than the truth. She hummed it into the fire, the whole weight of it, and it came out a note she had never sounded before, honest in a way her words had never been. The fire heard it. The valley heard it. Thrall heard it. He nodded once, and rose, and was gone into the dark, and Kale sat by the fire with the note still settling in her chest, the question asked and answered in the only language the question could live in, and she understood, dimly, that she had said more to him in one hum than she had said to anyone in her life. On the fourth day, Thrall did not appear. The promised 3 days had come and gone. The valley kept its own count. Kale noticed before she thought about it, the weight in the air missing, the stillness at the edge of every scene gone, the valley's hum one voice short. She looked for him at the edges of the terraces, at the top of the meeting cave steps, in the shape of the air where he had been standing. Nothing. The elders said nothing. She waited. She worked. By the fire, the children hummed back, and she answered them, watching the top of the terraces where Thrall's shape should have been. By midday she could not stand it anymore. He is in the memory caves.
He goes when he is deciding.
The memory caves. The words meant nothing to Kale and everything at once, the deep places behind the meeting cave, the carved walls, the older-than-old impressions she had been told not to touch. He goes when he is deciding.
I want to see him.
No.
The refusal was not unkind. It was not kind. It was simply the truth, spoken the way the valley spoke truth, without softening. Kale pushed. She had learned to push on Vorn, to carry the stone until the valley put another pair of hands on it, and she pushed now, asking again, explaining, offering, the words coming out the way words came out of her when she was afraid, small and precise and not the point. No. Kale opened her mouth to push a third time, and stopped. She had learned, in the days of shared work, that pushing in Uargrim is pushing stone. They did not move for words. They moved for the truth of the thing, and the truth of the thing was that Thrall was deciding. And deciding was not a thing that could be hurried, and every word she said was a Skaltor, a hollow speech, a noise in a conversation that would not be conducted in noise. She closed her mouth. She nodded. She went back to the fire and the children and the waiting was the hardest work she had ever done. That night, Thrall returned. Kale felt him before she saw him, the weight settling back into the air, the valley's hum finding its missing voice. He came down the terrace steps. He looked older. The days in the memory caves had taken something out of him, or put something in. His gray face was drawn, his shoulders bowed, the chitinous ridges of his hands holding his weight against the staff he carried. He found her by the fire. He stood over her for a long moment, and then he sat. And he spoke. His Ethrin was rough, learned from old trade scrolls, each word an effort, dragged up from a language he had never used for anything that mattered.
The Song of Binding. It is not a scroll. It is not a word. It is a relationship. You cannot take it. You can only enter it.
Kale stared at him. The words came from the wrong place, from the stone, from the hum, from a grammar that did not fit Ethryn's shape, and she understood each of them separately and none of them together. Thrall waited. The fire waited. The valley waited. He tried again, patient as stone, each word placed like a stone in a wall. The cave will sing to you. It tests what you carry, whether you can stay honest in the dark. If you cannot, it will close. I cannot help you inside. No one can. The risk, Kale understood, was not failure. Failure you could survive, learn from, try again. The cave did not promise failure. It promised something worse, the test of what she carried, whether she could stay honest in the dark, alone, with no one to perform for and no one to hide from, delivered by the mountain itself, in front of everyone, in front of the old one who had taught her to trust without words. She could not know if she was honest enough until she tried. She could not try without risking everything she had just learned to be. Thrall turned to go.
Why would you let me try?
He stopped. The fire held its shape. The valley's hum, far off, leaned in, listening as the fog had listened, as the shore had listened, as the whole gray north had been listening since before she was born. Thrall did not turn around. His voice, when it came, was the roughest thing she had heard from him, not effort, not trade scroll grammar, but the thing itself, spoken once, as the valley speaks a true note.
Because you hummed back.
That same night, Varen walked to the edge of the settlement. The promontory was a tongue of black rock hanging over the sea, the valley's edge, where the warm air met the gray water and the fog hung at the limit of sound, patient, waiting, keeping its distance as it had kept its distance since they landed. He had not prayed since the storm. The words would not come, the sea had unsung them, and the silence had listened to their shape and let them go, and the shape of a prayer, once listened to that way, does not fit the mouth again. Now he tried. His knees found the black rock, the way they had found the cold shrine floor at Valdris, at dawn. He closed his eyes. Shaped the words, the old ones that had held up his whole life, the office, and the order, and the warrant, and the mission. The structure that had made him a hunter and a priest and a man with a purpose. Nothing. No answer. No feeling. No presence. The silence was just silence, not the fog's listening silence, not the storm's vacuum, just the ordinary silence of a rock above a sea, holding nothing. He opened his eyes. The fog waited just past hearing, gray, patient, indifferent as weather. He had been told, his whole life, what the song was. Dangerous. Uncontrolled. The cause of the cataclysm, the breaking of the old world, the fall of the Orin Empire. The priesthood protected the new world by restricting it, hunting it, binding it, keeping the first tongue's fragments sealed and the memory keepers caged. He had believed it the way you believe weather. Not faith. The shape of the world he had been raised in, the air he had breathed. He had watched a girl from the Dales unsing a scroll. He had watched her unsing a sea. The text had failed him twice, and the text had been the whole of his life, and there was nothing left of the shape of the world he had been raised in except this, a man kneeling on black rock above a gray sea, praying to nothing, answered by nothing. The elder found him there. She came up the promontory path without sound, the same elder who had sat with him at the hot spring, the one who had wanted nothing from him and had not left, and she sat down on the rock beside him, and looked out at the sea, and did not speak. Varin did not speak. He had learned, in the days since the hot spring, that she would sit until he did, and that the sitting was not a demand. It was an offer. The offer was that he could be alone in front of her, and she would not fill the silence with words, and the silence would not be empty. The sea breathed. The fog waited. The hum of the valley, far behind them, was a warmth at their backs.
You were told the song is dangerous.
That it broke the old world. That the priesthood protects the new one by restricting it. Yes?
Varin's jaw tightened. The words were the words of his whole life, and hearing them spoken by a stranger, on a black rock above the sea, made them small.
Yes.
We were there.
We saw what happened. The priesthood's story is true, incomplete, and backward.
She turned her head, and her eyes of black stone upon black stone, patient as the cave she had lived in for 800 years, met his. Do you want to know what we saw? Varin's voice cracked. It was the first thing he had said in a long time that was completely honest.
Yes.
The elder looked back at the sea. She spoke as the valley spoke, unhurried, each word placed.
The shapers did not destroy the world. They unmade themselves, every one of them, by their own choice, to keep the song from falling into the hands that were reaching for it. The cataclysm was not a weapon. It was a sacrifice. The priesthood inherited the aftermath and called it a warning.
The words landed in Varin like stones in still water, one after another, each one a weight. Did not destroy the world. Sacrificed themselves. To keep the song from falling into hands that were reaching for it. The priesthood inherited the aftermath and called it a warning. Varin could feel his chest working, the breath coming in and out, the machinery of a body that had no idea what it was carrying.
Then everything.
He stopped. Started again, the sentence bare, no conditionals left in him. Everything I was taught. The danger. The restrictions. The hunting. You're telling me it was built on. It was built on a truth.
And the truth became a lie in the mouths of the ones who inherited it. They did not lie about what happened. They lied about what it meant. They called a sacrifice a weapon, and a warning a law, and they built their whole order on the ruins of the Shaper's love and called it safety.
The sea breathed against the black rock. The fog waited.
How do I live with that?
Varin's voice was a stranger's. He had no idea whose voice it was.
I gave my life to it. My whole life, every choice, every warrant, every, I believed, I was good at it, how do I live with knowing what it was?
The elder was silent for a long moment. You don't. You live with what comes after. She stood. She looked down at him, the priest who had knelt to a god that had not answered, on a rock above a sea that had unsung his prayers, and her folded gray face held nothing but patience, and she raised one hand and touched his shoulder, the way she had touched it at the hot spring, and then she was gone down the promontory path, and Varin was alone with the sea. He stayed on the rock until dawn. The fog waited at the edge of hearing. It had not moved, it had not spoken, it had not cared. And Varin, kneeling on the black rock above the gray sea with the ruins of his whole life inside him, pressed his hand to the stone and stayed there, empty, waiting to be filled with something. He did not know what, he could not name it, but the emptiness was the first honest thing he had carried in years. Asterisk, Varen's crisis is deliberately carried unresolved into Volume 6. The Elder's truth is the episode's second turning point, and his faith does not come back on the page. It is started here, not finished. Asterisk. The elders convened again on the fifth day, and this time they invited Kale in. She came alone into the meeting cave, the same circle of stones, the same four elders, the same thin gold glomos on the worn walls, and this time the hums did not begin. The elders sat in silence, and the silence had a shape, the way the valley's silence always had a shape, and the shape of this silence was a verdict waiting to be delivered. She had been called in to receive it. Kale understood. Not to argue it. The valley did not argue verdicts, it delivered them, as it delivered weather.
We have decided. You are not to enter the memory caves.
The words landed in Kale's chest like stones. She had known, in the 3 days of waiting, that this was possible, that the weeping elder had wept for a reason, that the cave might not want her, that everything she had learned in the valley, the children humming back, the stone lifted with her, the note she had sounded by the fire, might not be enough, because the cave was not the valley, and the valley's judgment was not the mountains. You are a surface dweller.
Your hum is young. It has not been shaped by the stone, by the thaws, by the centuries of sitting in the dark with the deep songs. The cave will reject you. This is not a judgment of your character.
She said it as the valley said everything, without softening. It is a fact of your making, as the heat of the spring is a fact of the stone. You were not made for the deep places, and the deep places were not made for you. Kale stood in the circle of stones with the verdict in her chest and the fragment warm in her pack and nothing to say. Because there was nothing to say, she had not earned the cave, and the cave would not accept her unearned, and unworthiness, she had learned. Could not be argued with. However,
that is not the end of the matter. There is another course. You may stay on Vorn. Learn Skeltor, the hollow speech, the speech of strangers, the trade tongue we give to those who cannot hum. Serve as a bridge between the Urgrim and the surface world. You will be honored. You will be safe. You will live out your life among us. A lifetime of useful exile, and the word you carry will be kept and studied and sung about for 100 thaws.
A lifetime of useful exile. Honor bound. Safe. The valley, warm and patient, humming its one note. The children learning her tune. The fire by which she had sounded a true note for the first time in her life. The bridge, the useful, honored, safe bridge, between the world she had left and the world that had carried her. Kale could feel the shape of that life, could feel it fitting her like a coat made for someone else's shoulders, and she opened her mouth to answer. And Thrall spoke. The first time he had spoken in front of the elders. The rough Ethrin, dragged up from the trade scrolls, placed in the air of the meeting cave like a stone in a wall. One word.
No.
The room went still. The glow-moss held its light. The valley's hum, far off, stopped its argument, listening. Thrall stood at the entrance of the meeting cave. He had come in behind Kale, or he had been there all along, she could not tell. The air had shifted the way it shifted when he entered a place. And now he stood in the doorway with the gold light behind him and the whole weight of the valley at his back.
No songs loaned by fear,
he said. The words were effort, each one placed, but the harmonics under them did not waver.
The cave does not test worthiness. It tests honesty. The worthiness is the door, the honesty is the key. She carries the word we have been waiting for.
He looked at the elders, one by one, the blackstone eyes holding each of them the way he had held Kale on the shore.
She answered the fog's call. She hummed back to me. She has been honest in every wordless thing she has done. She has carried the stone, and burned her hand, and sat with the children, and sounded a true note by the fire. Let her try.
She is a surface dweller. The cave has not known her kind in.
The cave has not known her kind in 800 years.
It has been waiting longer than that. It has been waiting for a true note.
The harmonics under his voice, Kale heard them now, the low steady weight of them, the way they did not waver, as they had not wavered when he had stood across the fire from her and asked his question.
The word she carries is the word we were set to guard. She has carried it across the black water, through the fog, to the door of the cave. And you would turn her away for the shape of her ears.
The elders began to argue. They argued in Uargrim, the hums, the clicks, the harmonics stacking and resolving and refusing, and Kale understood none of it, but she understood the shape of it as she understood the shape of weather, the four voices turning on each other, the youngest elder's harmonics rising against Thrall, the eldest's deep note weighing, and Thrall's voice, the one Ethryn voice in the room, standing against them all, not loud, patient as the stone, holding its note while the argument broke over it. He was defending her, the old one who had read her on the shore, who carried the memory of the word she had brought, standing in the door of the cave where his people decided things, choosing a surface dweller over his own council. The harmonics did not waver. When it was over, Kale could not have said how long it took. The eldest elder turned to her, and the meeting cave was silent, and the verdict had changed shape. You will enter the memory caves at dawn.
Thrall will guide you to the threshold. After that, you are alone.
Kale looked at Thrall. He looked back, blackstone eyes holding hers, and she understood what he had done. He had bet his standing with his own counsel on her silence, on the honesty of a note she had sounded by the fire. If she failed, she lost the elders' trust. And Thrall lost his standing with them. He had bet his reputation on her. She opened her mouth to thank him, to promise, to make it right with words, and closed it again. The words were not the point. He had not defended her words. He had defended her hum. She nodded, and walked out into the gold-green light, the door open at her back, the weight of what he had risked for her settled in her chest, warm, patient, waiting. The night before the cave, Kale did not sleep. She sat by the hot spring, the still pool at the valley's edge where the water lay warm and mineral bright under the gloamos, with her hands in the water up to the wrists, feeling the mountain's pulse through her palms. The pulse was low and steady, patient as everything on Vorn, and it was the pulse of the same stone she would put her hands against at dawn, and it did not feel like a verdict. It felt like a held note, waiting. Valani found her there. Kale heard the trader's step on the stone before she saw her, the particular weight of a woman who moved like cargo moving across a deck, certain, unapologetic, and then Valani sat down beside her, shoulder to shoulder, and did not speak. They sat like that for a long time. The spring steamed. The valley hummed its one note. Kale's hands in the warm water, Valani's hands in her lap, the two of them shoulder to shoulder like they had sat 100 nights on 100 decks, watching water together. I told the elder you were mine. Kale did not move. The words had been hanging between them since the healing cave, carried in 100 unspoken things. I didn't mean to. Valani's voice was the flat one, the dry one, the voice that meant the opposite of flat and dry.
It just came out, in front of everyone.
I've held cargo claims in every port from Kesh to the Cold Father. I've signed manifests, sworn oaths, haggled for hours over the ownership of a barrel of Suniron. And the first thing I've ever actually claimed without thinking about it was... She stopped. The sentence hung, bare, no conditionals, the way Varen's sentences had been hanging since the storm.
You.
The word sat between them in the warm air. Kale did not know what to say. The words were not the point, she had learned that on Vorn, but Valani had said a true thing, in a language that mattered, and the true thing needed an answer that was not a hum, it needed her hand. She took Valani's hand. Valani's grip tightened, once, quick, the way you tighten a line before you trust it, and then eased, and they sat like that, hands together in the steam, until the stars shifted over the valley and the mountain's pulse ran on underneath them, patient, waiting. Mellon appeared briefly, at the edge of the spring's light. He was carrying something, a book, Kale saw, a stone tablet bound in leather, the kind of thing that belonged in the scriptorium cave. His scholar's hands were trembling with the particular joy of a man who has found the text of his life and cannot stop reading it.
I found something.
In the scriptorium cave. A reference, it's in the oldest layer, before the piece, before, it's the 7th node. There's a reference to the 7th node. He stopped, looked at the tablet, looked at Kale.
I need more time. I need to verify. I need to be sure before I...
He did not say what. The book was pressed against his chest like a child.
You're going to do it. Tomorrow. What no surface dweller has done in 800 years.
The first one to read the deep song since. Mellon.
She's trying not to think about tomorrow.
Mellon blinked. The ecstasy cleared. For a moment he was just the young scholar with the bandaged head and the borrowed pilgrimage, and he said.
Right. Of course. I'll be at the cave mouth. Watching.
He looked at Kale again, and the newness was still in his eyes, and he went away down the terrace path, carrying the 7th node's reference against his chest, and the night was quiet again. Thrall came to the edge of Kale's vision. He did not approach. He never approached. Not all the way, he came to the edge of things and stood, as he had stood at the edge of every scene she had been in since the shore. At the edge of the spring's light, a distance away, his back to a stone, he hummed. A low, steady note. Not a question, not a demand. A held tone, warm, patient, the note a man hums when he is keeping watch, or keeping faith. Or saying goodbye in the only language he has that does not need to be translated. Blessing, farewell, or prayer. Kale closed her eyes and listened. The hum entered her chest, she felt it move through the warm air, through the steam, through the stone she was sitting on, and settle in the hollow where her own note lived, a second voice in the room of her chest, old and patient and not asking for anything. It stayed there, holding its note, and Kale sat in the steam with Valani's hand in hers and Thrall's hum in her chest and the mountain's pulse under her palms, and she did not go back. She could still refuse. That was the terrible, merciful shape of it. The safe life was still offered. She could walk into the meeting cave at dawn and say the words, the hollow speech, the useful words, the words that made her a bridge instead of a door, and the valley would keep her, honored, safe, humming its one note forever. She could stay. She sat in the steam with Valani's hand in hers and Thrall's hum in her chest, and she did not go back, and the mountain's pulse ran on under her palms, patient, waiting for her to be ready. Dawn came the way it came on Vorn, gray, warm, the valley's steam rising white into the first light, the hum of the stone steady as breath. Thrall came for her himself. He stood at the edge of the healing cave while she gathered herself, the fragment in her pack, the note in her chest, the memory of Valani's hand and the held hum of the night before, and he did not hurry her. When she was ready, she nodded, and he turned and led her through the settlement. The elders watched from their doorways, four gray shapes in the gold-green light, patient as the stone. The children were not there, the valley had kept them inside, Kale did not know why, as the valley kept certain things from the young until they were old enough to hum their weight. The healing elder met Kale's eyes once, and nodded, a small motion, the same nod Thrall had given her by the fire, and then the procession moved on. Valani walked with them as far as the edge of the geothermal clearing. She stopped there, at the line where the settlement stone gave way to the open black rock, and she said nothing. She could not follow. None crossed the line while the cave was open, the elder's words, spoken without softening, and Valani, the trader who had carried Kale across a dead flat sea, could not carry her past this line. Kale saw her jaw set, the way it set when she was refusing to say something, and she saw the traitor's hands at her sides, open, empty, and she understood the shape of it. Valani had done everything a person could do, and nothing could follow her into this.
Wait for me.
Valani's mouth moved. The words that came out were not the ones she would have chosen, Kale thought, they were the dry ones, the flat ones, the ones that meant their opposite.
Where would I go?
Kale walked on. The cave mouth was hidden behind a steam vent, a black opening in the rock, roughly hewn, exhaling warm air into the dawn like a held breath released. The vent hissed, the air smelled of mineral and deep stone and something older, the smell of the world's own bones. The elders had gathered at the edge of the clearing, at the limit of the open ground, and they watched in silence, for gray figures, patient as verdicts. Thrall stopped at the threshold. He turned. For the first time since the shore, since the fire, since every scene she had been in where he had been only at the edge of things, he looked at her directly, his black stone eyes holding hers fully, and Kale stood in the middle of his looking and felt the whole weight of it, 800 years of the valley's patient keeping, one last guardian standing at the door of the place that held everything his people had guarded, looking at the girl who had sounded a true note by his fire. He sang. Not a hum, a true note, open-throated, rising from the bottom of his chest, the sound of stone breaking and reforming, of a wall being taken down and a door being opened, the first song Kale had heard him sing, the song of a man who has decided to believe in something one last time. The cave answered. A harmonic rose from deep inside the mountain, a tone so low it was felt before it was heard, in the arches of the feet, in the sternum, in the hollow where Kale's note lived, and it rose to meet Thrall's note and held it, the stone and the singer singing together, and Kale stood in the middle of the two notes and understood, dimly, that she was hearing the cave and the deep singer greet each other after a long absence. Thrall finished his note. The cave's harmonic lingered, settling, waiting. Silence.
The cave knows you are here,
Thrall said. His voice was rougher than the note, effort dragged up from the trade scrolls, but the harmonics under it did not waver.
It has known since you landed. Go now. I will wait.
Kale looked past him into the dark, the warm breath of the cave on her face, the black opening, the hum waiting inside it, and then she looked back at the clearing where Valani stood, and the elders watched, and the gold-green valley hummed behind them all, and she looked at Thrall, the old one who had read her on the shore and bet his standing on her silence. She stepped into the dark. The step was a choice she could not undo. Behind her, the cave's breath closed over the light, and the hum rose to meet her, patient as the stone, older than the valley, older than the fog, older than the word she carried, the deep world itself, waiting for her since before she was born. The dark was not dark for long. The walls of the memory cave were slick with mineral deposits that glowed faintly phosphorescent, a green-gold light that rose from the stone itself, catching in the wet sheen, laying a soft glow over the passage. The air was warm, close, breathing in and out with the mountain's slow pulse. And the hum was everywhere and nowhere, all around her and inside her, rising from the stone itself, from the air, from the floor under her feet, the same note the shore had hummed, the same note the valley hummed, but older, deeper, more specific, a note that had been held in this rock since before the world's memory. Kale walked deeper, following the narrowing tunnel. The hum grew stronger as she walked, not louder exactly, more pointed, more shaped, as if it were learning her, measuring her, finding the shape of her in the dark. It leaned toward her as the fog had leaned toward her hum, as Thrall's note had leaned toward the cave's answer, and Kale felt it in her chest, in her wrists, in the arches of her feet, a second pulse under her own. The tunnel opened into a chamber. The walls here were covered in markings, not writing, someone had told her, and now she saw what that meant. Not writing. Impressions. The stone was worn by touch, a thousand hands over a thousand years, each hand leaving a harmonic signature pressed into the rock, layered and resting and waiting, the whole history of a people written in the pressure of their hands against the mountain's skin. Kale stood in the middle of the chamber with the hum all around her, and she understood, with a clarity that hurt, what she was being asked to do. The hum was waiting for her to touch it. She pressed her palm to the wall. The stone was warm, warmer than the air, the warmth of a body sleeping, and the hum changed. It rose to meet her touch, the note bending and opening, becoming a song, becoming about her, and Kale. Her father's hands. The memory surged with a force that nearly dropped her, his rough palms, the calluses from ropework, the tremor in his fingers when he was scared, the way he had held her hand when she was small, the warmth of him that had sealed itself into the hollow where her wire lived, the reason she did not sing in front of others, the thing she had spent 10 years not looking at. His hands. Her father's hands. The last warmth she had carried out of her childhood, and the cave was giving them back to her, the whole weight of them, the love and the rope calluses and the tremor. She pulled back. Her palm came off the stone. The impression of it stayed a moment, a fading harmonic in the wet rock, and Kale stood shaking in the middle of the chamber with her father's hands behind her eyes and the hollow in her chest where the wire had been, wide open, raw. The hum did not stop. It did not pull away. It did not judge. It waited, the note holding, patient, asking her to stay. Not demanding. Asking. The way the valley asked. The way Thrall had asked, across the fire. Asterisk the cave does not test worthiness. It tests honesty, asterisk. Kale stood in the middle of the chamber, shaking, with the memory of her father's hands in her and the hum waiting around her, and she understood the test. It was not danger. It was intimacy. The cave was showing her the thing she had spent 10 years not looking at, and the question was not whether she could survive it. The question was whether she would run from it. She pressed her hands to the wall, both hands, flat, fingers spread. The hum rose to meet them. It entered her through her palms, through her wrists, up her arms into her chest, and it settled where her own hum lived, the two notes meeting and holding. And for a moment Kale was not alone in her body, the cave was with her, old and patient and full of grief that was not hers but that she understood, the grief of a world that had been holding its note alone for 800 years, waiting for someone to answer it. Her father's hands were there. She did not run from them. She held the wall, and the cave held her, and the hum sang to her, not in words, in the only language the deep world had, the language of held notes and waiting in the shape of a hand pressed to stone, and Kale stayed like that, hands on the wall, as the cave sang. She did not know how long. When she opened her eyes, she was kneeling. Her hands had come away from the wall without her deciding it, and the hum had changed again, quieter, settled, waiting, the note that had been reaching for her now resting, satisfied, the way a chord rests after it resolves. She had been taught something. She could not name it. It was in her the way the note was in the stone, in the hollow where her own hum lived, a second thing now, braided with the first. The song of binding had begun its work. Kale knelt in the glowing dark with her father's hands somewhere behind her eyes and the cave's note settled in her chest, and she understood, dimly, that she had not been judged worthy or unworthy. The cave had not tested her worthiness at all. It had tested her honesty. And she had stayed. She emerged from the cave at dusk. The valley's light had gone golden low, the steam rising white into the evening, and Kale came out of the black opening like a swimmer coming up for air, pale, swaying, her eyes unfocused, her hands still pressed together in front of her chest as if she were holding something between her palms. She was smiling. A thin, exhausted smile, the smile of someone who had survived something she could not describe. The smile of a thing too large for words, carried carefully, the way you carry water cupped in your hands. Thrall was where she had left him. He had not moved. He stood at the threshold, black stone eyes on the cave mouth, patient as the stone he stood on, and when Kale came out he looked at her, the whole of his attention, as he had looked at her on the shore, as he had looked at her in the meeting cave, and he nodded. One nod. It was enough. Valani broke the elder's rule. She had been standing at the edge of the geothermal clearing, where she had stood at dawn, and now she ran, the first time Kale had ever seen Valani run, the trader who moved like cargo across a deck breaking into a flat, desperate sprint across the black rock. And she caught Kale as Kale swayed, two arms around her, taking her weight the way she had taken it on a dead flat sea. Kale leaned into her. The smile did not leave her face. Her voice, when it came, was a whisper, raw, the voice of someone who had been sung to for a long time.
I heard it. The first note. It's been waiting for me since before I was born.
Valani held her, and said nothing, and the flat delivery cracked down the middle the way it cracked when she could not hide the awe of it, and Kale stood in the circle of her arms with the cave's note in her chest and the valley humming its one note all around them. And she had never been so tired and so whole in her life. Varen watched from the edge of the clearing. He had come down from the promontory, Kale did not know when, could not have said if he had been there all day, his gray robe motionless against the black rock, and he stood at the edge of the light, watching the girl in the trader's arms, the girl who had walked into the mountain and come out singing without having sung a single word. His face was unreadable. His hands were shaking. The song of binding was real. Realer than anything his texts had described, the texts that had told him it was dangerous, uncontrolled, the cause of the cataclysm, the weapon that had broken the old world. He had watched a girl from the Dales walk into the deep world and come out carrying its note, and the elder's words on the promontory were true, and the priesthood story was true, incomplete, and backward. And everything he had believed was a story told to control him. He did not know what to do with his shaking hands. He stood at the edge of the light, and he watched, and the cave hummed behind the girl like a held note, waiting for her to be ready to use it. Melon arrived with a book in his hands, tripping over his robes.
Kale. Kale, I was right. I was, listen to me.
He had the stone tablet from the scriptorium cave in his arms, his scholar's hands shaking around it, the ecstatic concentration replaced by something sharper, a man who has just connected two texts that should never have been connected. The seventh node. I found it. It's not a place, it's a person. A line of people. Memory keepers. The oldest layer describes them. The seventh node was never a location. It was a line, a succession, and the fragments of it were scattered and the line was broken in. He stopped, looked at Kale, the words falling out of him in a rush.
A line broken, and the fragments scattered. It has to be her. Kale is a fragment of the seventh node.
The words hung in the air. A fragment of the seventh node. Kale did not react. She was too far gone, too full of the cave's note, too spent to take the words in. But the words hung there, in the gold dusk, in the steam, in the valley's listening air, and Varen heard them, and Valani heard them, and Melon stood holding the tablet with the look of a man who has just read the first line of the text of his life. A fragment. She had come to Vorn carrying a word. She would leave carrying a song. The cave harbor at dawn. The tide kind had been made ready, Valani's sail mended, the hull patched with valleycraft, the stores laid in, and the ship stood in the sea cave with her mended mast and her patched sail, ready for open water. The party had gathered on the black sand, Valani at the ship's bow, checking the lines, her hands moving in the old rhythms, Melon at the gangplank with his stone tablet wrapped in sailcloth, Varen at the waterline, not praying, looking at the far gray water. Thrall stood at the edge of the shore. He was coming with them. He had not said it, the valley had not forbidden it, and Thrall, the old one who had read her on the shore and stood with her at the cave's threshold, walked out of the settlement at dawn carrying a small stone pack, and the elders watched him go from their doorways, four gray figures, patient as verdicts, and no one stopped him. He had never left Vorn. Kale stood at the rail, her hands still pressed together, holding the cave's resonance between her palms, The note she had been given, braided now with the hum that had always lived in the hollow of her chest, inseparable. Valani gave the order to cast off. The ship moved out of the cave harbor into open water, the black cliffs sliding past, the steam vents breathing white into the gray morning. And from the black shore, a hum. Lower than before. Parting, reluctant, the note the valley had held for 800 years turning toward the ship one last time, the elder's farewell, sung into the stone, the whole of Vorn saying goodbye in the only language it had. Kale stood at the rail, and answered it, not loud, a small rise of the hum in her chest, a note held out across the water, an answer without a language. The shore heard it. And at the edge of hearing, far out, the fog was still there. It had not moved. It had been waiting, through landfall and healing, through the long days of work and the judgment of the elders and the cave's song, patient as the stone, as it had waited since the ship came through the strait, as it had waited since before she was born. Kale stood at the rail and looked at it. She had been taught the first word the Uargrim give to a stranger, and it was not a word at all. It was a hum. And it meant I am listening. The fog waited at the edge of hearing, and Kale, for the first time, was not afraid of it. The song of binding had begun.